The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
So this stuff is really fundamental. You're absolutely right. It's not a nice to have. Without this, we have no global economy and we have no life on Earth, really.
The environmentalist and campaigner Tony Juniper comes in to discuss the economic and social value of the natural world. According to him, money really does grow on trees. And the neurologist Sir Roger Bannister explains why fingers and toes wrinkle when they get wet. And we'll discuss the possibility of life on other planets, or rather, the moons of other planets. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Tony Juniper is a tireless activist on environmental and sustainability issues, who has and continues to work at the helm of a dizzying array of conservation and environmental campaigns. They've included Friends of the Earth, the 1010 Carbon Reduction Initiative, the Prince of Wales Charities, and he's a senior associate at the University of Cambridge Programme for Sustainability Leadership. You'll therefore believe me when I say that he has a deep understanding of the sometimes surreal politicking needed to get governments and wider society to act to protect the value of the planet. His latest book is an attempt to correct all this. It's got the Python-esque title, What Has Nature Ever Done For Us? And he joins me in the studio. Tony, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for coming in.
Great pleasure.
Now tell us, what kinds of things does nature do for us that we can't do for ourselves?
Well, nature is inspiring. It's beautiful. It's of value for its own reasons because it's there. It helps to inspire the human spirit. But the book I've presented now, What Has Nature Ever Done For Us, is really taking the argument onto another level and talking about the economic value of nature and how the global economy and the process of development and poverty reduction is underpinned by services provided by nature. And of course, one of the things that prevails in the popular discourse in some countries, including here, is the mistaken view that somehow economic development is being held back and growth is being slowed down if we invest in protecting nature. And obviously, environmental rules and laws have been under attack in recent times, including in this country, because they're perceived to be a slowdown on economic growth as a result. Now, this couldn't be further from the truth, and that mythology I've tried to bust by presenting lots of different arguments through examples of how those natural services are, in fact, the opposite to a drag on development. They're actually essential for development, and we have to protect them for that reason.
So you're talking about ecosystem services, essentially.
Indeed, I am.
Give me some examples of what those are.
So ecosystem services is the technical jargon that I've tried to avoid in this book, and so I've really tried to talk about this through the examples speaking for themselves, and so some of them will be quite familiar to people. So the replenishment of fresh water is one. Another is the way in which soil fertility is renewed and thereby enabling global food security. I talk around the values of so-called biological diversity, wildlife effectively, and all the different species on Earth in terms of the ways in which they enable food to be produced, the extent to which they are vital for the pharmaceutical and medical industries, and the growing understanding we have around the way in which designs invented by nature through natural selection can be helpful for us in solving engineering challenges, for example, so-called biomimicry. I talk about the ways in which property is protected from extreme events through natural systems, for example, peat bogs slowing down runoff of rain and thereby reducing flood risk, the ways in which mangroves and coral reefs defend coastal areas from flooding, the productivity of the oceans and the fact that we get $274 billion worth of GDP per year from natural replenishment and renewal of fish stocks. And I talk about the ways in which nature helps to improve human health and well-being. And this is a really underestimated economic value, in my view, and something certainly that public health services could be learning more from. So it's very wide-ranging, and the payoff, really, once you add up all these services, is to see estimates in the order of those natural services of an economic value about double global GDP, which is a huge number, of course. And yet we're growing GDP, often at the expense of those natural services, by turning forests into timber, by turning rangelands into agricultural land, by turning fish stocks into cat food. Whatever we're doing with these particular services, they're being depleted. We're counting that as GDP. And of course, the opposite is in fact the case. We're depleting the capital.
Now, we'll talk a little bit later about how you go about putting these sorts of monetary costs onto the services we've just talked about, and the sort of errors and approximations that you have to make. But going back to the examples. I mean, you talked specifically about coastal defences and all these, but I mean, there are even bigger examples of ecosystem services, things like energy capture, the idea that, of course, plants capture almost all of our energy from the sun.
Right.
And that's an amazing way of getting energy into the system. And that's probably the only way from the external, from the sun itself.
Yes.
Pollination from bees and pollinators.
Yes.
These things are all important. And you can argue that without these things, human society actually can't exist.
Yes, that's basically it. And you know, there's some of these things.
It's not a nice to have; it's a must have.
Exactly. Some of these things are so fundamental that the process of photosynthesis, which is invented on the Earth about 2.5 billion years ago, initially by cyanobacteria, and now which has been honed in different ways and is now used by the higher plants to convert sunshine into complex molecules. And of course, that's the basis of the entire human economy. And indeed, even the fossil fuels that we mine out of the ground were originally created through photosynthesis. So that ability to convert sunlight into useful materials obviously is at the base of this. And of course those plants are being fed by water that's being endlessly recycled across the planet, and it's not only coming from clouds evaporating from the sea. The oceanic plankton are playing a role in enabling the clouds to form by producing chemicals which create the nuclei around which the vapor can form, thereby transporting fresh water across the planet. So this stuff is really fundamental. You're absolutely right, it's not a nice to have. Without this, we have no global economy, and we have no life on Earth, really.
So why do you think that you felt compelled to write this book? Because you've spent a career talking about the environment and campaigning for it and getting legislation passed and making sure that people are aware of these issues. Do you think we don't know this stuff? Not enough people know?
Well, it's surprising. You know, sometimes I'd sit down and read drafts and I'd think, well, isn't this obvious? And then I'd hear George Osborne make some statement in the Conservative Party conference or in a policy announcement saying that conservation rules were a ridiculous drag on business. And I'd think, yes, this book really is needed. Because we have in our collective consciousness, many of us, taken on board this idea that looking after nature is automatically expensive, automatically against the interests of economic development. And that is a disastrous mistake. It's possibly the gravest misconception of modern times, in my view. And so busting that myth with data and showing how the data stacks up in real-world examples, I thought was a job that needed doing. And I come to this having campaigned, as you say, for many, many years on environmental issues, motivated by the beauty of nature and nature's intrinsic values. And I don't see the economic arguments being an alternative to that. It's not either or, it's both and. Nature is beautiful and it's also vital for economic development. And I think we need to get that view much more into the mainstream and then the tools adopted to reflect that economic value in how we make decisions. And it's simply not there at the moment. And I think for me, this is really the kind of cutting edge of the modern environmental argument, because we have got as far as we've got over the last 30 years in, you know, for example, phasing out ozone depleting chemicals, getting rid of some of the worst industrial pollution. We've protected some of the world's most important areas for biodiversity. But to go to the next stage, we need to do much more. We're not doing much more, in large part because of the perceived economic downside of doing much more. And so we need to bust the economic myth in order to get to the next level of sustainability, in my opinion.
So this is more of an investment in future economic growth in terms of if you want to protect a forest, for example, or a habitat of some sort, rather than saying we're protecting this habitat, it's going to just cost money for people to sort of make sure that nothing gets destroyed in there.
Yes, indeed. And it's not only about the protected areas. I mean, that's been one of the most important tools we've had over many years in slowing down the damage being caused to nature. But some of the things that we need to protect, the replenishment of fresh water, soil fertility, pollinating insects, the protection of property from extreme weather, all of those things are in large part provided by natural areas outside of the protected national parks and what have you. So we need to take a wider view that takes nature much more into the mainstream. And, you know, the approach we've taken on national parks and nature reserves, it's been good, it's been effective, one of the best things we've done. But what it's helped to create is a perception that nature can be put into a little piece on its own, protected, and then we can carry on as we'd like outside that. And I guess the book is saying in some ways that that's simply not right. You know, we're embedded in nature as much as the birds, the trees and the flowers, and we need to have that reality reflected in our economic decision making.
Is there in your career, can you give an indication of how whether the situation has got better or worse in terms of how much we're losing, how much potentially are we going to lose with this? More people are aware of the environment than ever before, and so in a sense we're in a good place when it comes to campaigning. But you obviously feel like there's a need to remind people of all these numbers and all these monetary values, and this is the language people speak nowadays, money. Mm-hmm. So have you seen the situation get better or worse in your sort of time?
Well, you're right in the sense that, you know, things have got better in the level of public awareness. There is a pretty seamless consensus across politics and business of the need for a more sustainable approach to how we live. There are, you know, wrinkles in this, and I mentioned George Osborne. He's possibly the biggest wrinkle we have at the moment. But the trend has been for more acceptance, for more awareness. There are more treaties, there's more national laws. So we have moved into a better place in the sense of the level of engagement and some of the tools we got out there to deal with these challenges. But of course, at the same time, human demands on the earth have been rising very rapidly and overwhelming those positive steps. And so now we have, you know, 1.5-2 billion people living fairly comfortable middle-class lifestyles. That's going to double, possibly triple, over the next few decades.
And we want that to happen.
We want that to happen, yeah, from the point of view of poverty reduction, but what we don't want is the ecological consequences of that demand undermining the future prospects of other people a couple of generations hence to be enjoying good, healthy, high standards of living. So it's about investing in nature to protect those healthy lifestyles that we want everybody to have. And that's where the conceptual shift is needed in order to be able to do that development at the same time as hanging on to the natural services which are enabling it to happen. And we're not there yet, not by a long way.
So how do we shift this? There is still that stubborn thing where people think something is environmentally friendly, if you want to use those words, or sustainable. It's going to cost a little bit more because those economic costs haven't been met yet, and just burning fossil fuels, whatever, is just a bit cheaper. So let's do it that way and get rid of poverty, and then we can think about the environment. You're obviously, you wouldn't agree with that. So
no.
Give us your sort of tips on what we need to start thinking about in terms of sustainable development, yeah, that makes it attractive to people who, yeah, want to do all these things.
Well, I think at the highest conceptual level, the idea I come with in the book is the need for us to conceive of a bioeconomy, I call it. And so this is a fusion between the human economy and the biosphere. And the biosphere is the Earth's zone of life. So the water, the ecosystems, the atmosphere interacting together, maintaining all of those services at the same time as building economic development through seeing these things as two sides of the same coin. So how do we do that? Well, there's lots of different ways in which we can do this. Once you make that conceptual shift in terms of co-designing solutions through engineering, which are protecting nature as well as protecting the human world through the way in which we develop technology, the way in which we try to change our culture to be more ecological. All of those things could be part of a bioeconomy. So at that high level, I think that's the objective we have to have in mind. At a more specific level, some of the tools we might adopt would be, for example, much more integrated reporting from businesses in the financial sector. And there's a lot of work being done on this right now, some progress being made through the Integrated International Reporting Initiative, for example, Reporting Council, rather, and through various initiatives being taken by individual companies like Unilever and Puma, who are trying to do the numbers differently, and coming with something beyond the financial bottom line, so that when we see company reports and reports from financial institutions, we have an ecological bottom line and a social bottom line alongside the financial one. So that's very specific, very much something which is in the accountancy world, but contributing to that higher vision of seeing the human ethnosphere, if you will, being embedded much more in the biosphere in a way where the two are working together and there are synergies that are positive rather than negative. But I think this is really a conceptual shift. I think most of the tools that we need to do this, we already have. It's about making that leap into seeing reality slightly differently.
So, Tony, tell us how you actually calculate the dollar cost of a mangrove forest or a bit of ocean or, you know, an ecosystem of some sort.
Well, the economic valuations, they vary across the different methodologies used by the different scientists. But basically, it comes down to what it would cost to do things without those natural services. And one of the most famous studies of all, Robert Costanza's paper presented in Nature, which I cite a couple of times in the book, basically looked at the contribution from nature to the economy in terms of soil fertility, replenishment of fresh water, pollination, coastal defences, and said if you took all those things away, how much would it cost us to replace them if we possibly could? And actually, there's a good example in the book of Chinese farmers climbing in apple and pear orchards in the spring with feather dusters, pollinating the trees by hand, because all the bees have been killed by chemicals. They're still doing that.
Is this the future for us as well?
Well, unfortunately, it could be the future for planet Earth if we allow these services to continue to be degraded. And so, you know, the bees are doing it for nothing. People climbing the trees with feather dusters, that obviously costs. And so you can do the calculations through that kind of route.
Do you think there's a role for technology in this as well? Yes. All sorts of things. I mean, wind farms, for example, solar cells, genetic modification in terms of crops. All these things could be used to get more value out of what we already have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think technology is vital, but I point out in my description of the bioeconomy how some of the things that nature does for us can be done much better and much more cheaply by nature. So, for example, we might invest a great deal of money in carbon capture and storage in this country, when in fact we could be storing carbon much more cheaply and more sustainably through enhancing peatlands and through slowing down deforestation. And so the costs of absorbing carbon in a natural tropical rainforest, it's being done effectively for nothing. There is some cost in protecting the forest, but it's much cheaper than investing in a CCS plant, carbon capture and storage plant. So I think we need to juxtapose technology alongside these natural services and see where technology can add something, and not see technology necessarily as an alternative to what nature is doing for us. Another example would be hard structures made of concrete and steel to secure public water supplies. And I talk about the example of New York City in the book, where a decision was taken in the 1990s to sustain the water supply for the city through protecting forests and pasture just outside, which filtered the water, it stored the water, and did it much more cheaply than the engineering solution, building reservoirs and pipes and concrete conduits, would have done. So there are plenty of examples. Another one would be conserving coastal mangroves and coral reefs, which help to protect coasts more cheaply than concrete sea defences, for example. And so these kinds of solutions whereby technology is working with nature, I think, probably is the way forward, and not only from the point of view of sustaining nature, but also because it makes more economic sense to do that.
But we also have to be a bit practical here, because CCS might be something that the UK government decides to invest in, and the companies here do. But that's because we can do that. We don't have a forest the size of the Amazon that we can look after, unless you're talking about a sort of a global governance sort of model.
Well, international cooperation is absolutely vital for this. And you know, the Norwegians are investing in carbon capture and storage at some level, but are also investing in conserving the rainforests of Brazil, Indonesia, and Guyana. And so, again, it's not either or. I don't argue against carbon capture and storage technology from the point of view of using depleted gas fields, for example. I do think it's a technology we need. But at the same time, I think it's important to know that nature's also doing it, and by protecting nature, we can get a big hit there too.
I think we're on the same page in terms of doing all these things. But you've been involved in international government attempts to get these sorts of programs running. They're really difficult. The IPCC has tried its hardest to show the evidence, for example, for climate change, and the international governments just don't seem to want to move very far with it. The RED scheme has come, certainly has had some impact, but it's not moving too fast enough. We need to move faster on all these things.
We do.
Are you optimistic?
Yes, I think, like most environmentalists, I have moments of pessimism, but in the end, the thing that keeps us all going is the optimism that things can change and things can be better. I am optimistic about the future, because everything that we have is already there. It's a question of scaling it up and getting it moving. And I think it's really a combination of bottom-up and top-down. I think we need those international processes, difficult though they are, fraught and complicated though they are. We need to continue having those dialogues at the global level. But at the same time, I think we need to inspire the idea that there is a solution to this through demonstrating things from the bottom up. And actually, the book really kind of comes with that spirit, because it's based on many examples of countries, of companies, of individuals, of local initiatives, and really hopefully putting across the idea that if we gave scale to all of these, then taking best practice and harnessing it worldwide, these problems are solvable.
But in a sense, you've moved your debate into the territory of the people who are a bit, who don't want to move very quickly. So, for example, George Osborne talks about, you mentioned him, the Chancellor of the UK, he wants to talk about money, he wants to talk about GDPs and all this stuff.
Yes.
And you've moved your evidence into his arena so that
he can't
sort of say, this doesn't work anymore.
Well, hopefully, if the ideas in this kind of book become mainstream, then the Chancellor would start to look very, very foolish indeed if he continued to make the kinds of claims that he has as to the extent that environmental controls are somehow a drag on development. If you don't have a functioning set of natural services, you don't have an economy. And it's a simple point to make, but the fact that he can still get away with saying that, I think, says a great deal about the state of the conversation at the moment. So hopefully we're moving into territory whereby, through using numbers, which are dollar-based, which are about GDP, and applying them in an ecological context, it will be impossible for people like George Osborne to say the opposite to what's the truth.
So you know, this government said, the coalition government said it was going to be the greenest government ever.
Yes.
We're two and a bit years in now. What's the midterm report from you?
The midterm report on the British government, it's pretty appalling, I have to say.
They've abandoned all their targets.
Well, not only have they abandoned their targets, they've taken things into reverse in terms of how they have tried to roll back legislation, the way in which they've muted the voice of some of the official agencies, the way the funding has been scaled back. But most damaging of all is the political rhetoric. And again, just coming back to this idea of there being, you know, this false choice, the coalition government has really gone out of its way to present that false choice to the voters. And I think that makes it probably the least green government of modern times, actually. And I wonder whether there are opportunities for the coalition to redeem itself before the general election. And actually, there are one or two things that could enable it to get back onto the front foot on the green agenda, including some of the things that we're talking about here today. There is a group of businesses called the Ecosystems Markets Task Force, which will present a report in March this year, bringing forward proposals very much in the spirit of the book, talking about economic opportunities that also protect nature. So looking after wetlands and peat bogs to reduce flood risk, for example. But all these things will need government intervention to make them happen. And I think that will be a key moment for the coalition on the green agenda, actually, because these things are going to come from a business group. They're going to be based on sound economic analysis. And if at that point the coalition says we're not going to do this or is reluctant, I think we then know that the anti-green tinge on the coalition is ideological and not even fact-based at the level of their own analysis. And I think that's when we see the real colour of them in terms of the shade of green that they are.
Ideological in what sense do you mean?
In rejecting the environmental idea as something which is of the political left and which is anti to their free market, pro-competition, small government obsession. And I think once we have the Ecosystem Markets Task Force presenting and we see the reaction to the government on that, then I think we know where this is really coming from.
So isn't the answer to your sort of a challenge that businesses need to do this? It's not necessarily up to governments.
Well, I mean,
governments can provide
and.
Some leadership, but
yes.
If businesses take on board a lot of the economic arguments you're making,
yes,
then the government, well, their problems are solved.
In some way, except that there is a limit to how much you can do through the market and businesses operating in the market on their own. And so the Ecosystems Markets Task Force is a very good example of this, where you've got willingness from companies, including some very major brands. Also, you've got some leadership from companies already demonstrated. But the extent to which you get scale on that is really about the frameworks being established by government. Ecological taxation, for example, the way in which subsidies are being used, the regulatory environment, and actually the simple rhetoric and the extent to which they appear serious on these things. All of that is necessary to enable business to go further. And so, I welcome the business leadership, actually, and I do see a lot of encouragement from the extent to which some business leaders have now really understood this and moved their analysis of greenery beyond reputational enhancement and green consumerism into a much more strategic position about the long-term future of business. And so that, I think, is opening spaces for governments that weren't there before. And again, you know, George Osborne's commentary, he gives the impression that somehow business doesn't want environmental controls. That's just false. It's utterly false. Again, leading me to think that there is an ideological bent to this beyond the facts of the matter.
It's a strange thing, isn't it, though, that the green movement is sort of siding with business? Because traditionally there's been a bit of suspicion with business interests and the environment.
Well, I think a lot of people in the green side have seen a big strategic opportunity, not because business has gone green, but because some are showing leadership. And some of them are doing something, yeah. And that could put real pressure on those who are not. If those companies, whether they're in consumer goods or in construction or in energy, if they start to steal market share from those companies who are not doing anything, I think that makes for a really interesting market dynamic, especially in an economy that's not growing, because a lot of, most companies, they are obsessed with growth and profitability. If someone's getting more than them, that makes them very worried. If someone's getting more than them through being more sustainable, I think that could be a really powerful snowball effect could emerge off the back of that.
Tony Juniper, thank you very much.
Pleasure, thank you.
What Has Nature Ever Done For Us is published by Profile Books, and it's in all good bookshops from January the 14th. To learn more about Tony, you can visit his stylish website, tonyjuniper.com. If you like Science Weekly, which I'm assuming you do, given you're listening to this, you'll love the new Guardian Audio Edition.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, David Cameron's threat to block EU reforms branded economic insanity. Some surprising facts about hedgehogs. And in our audiobook review, we look at feminist audiobooks by Germaine Greer and Natasha Walter. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Let's take a look now at some of this week's science news stories. With me is The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, and also Maria Bocharova, who's working with us on the Guardian Science Desk for a while, but in real life is a PhD student at University College London. Welcome to you both. Maria, let's kick off with you and some wrinkly fingers. Wrinkly fingers, you know, if people are familiar with this because, you know, if you sat in the bath for a while, your toes, your fingers, they go wrinkly. There's an unexpected tale behind them, though. Why do they go wrinkly?
So what people used to think was that when you sat in the bath for a long time, all the water would kind of flow into the tips of your fingers and the volume would increase. So they'd kind of wrinkle up because there'd be too much skin there. But actually what they found out was that the volume of the fingertips actually gets smaller. And the reason that fingers get wrinkly, or the benefit of having these wrinkly fingers, is that when you pick something up when it's wet, so like if you're gathering stuff in the rain, or if you're fishing or using weapons, it helps you to pick up slightly slippery objects.
So a bit exactly. Like tread on a tire.
Yeah, exactly.
I love the idea of having weapons in your bathtub. But the research that we're talking about is done by Tom Smulders at Newcastle University. Mm-hmm. Tell us what he did to sort of try and show that the wrinkly fingers are actually useful for like tread.
So what he did was he thought of the most slippery thing that you could have, and he thought of glass marbles, and he invited a load of people in to come and move these glass marbles, and they moved them from a tub full of water, and they did that once with dry fingers and then with wrinkly fingers, and they found that actually they could do it with wrinkly fingers a lot quicker. So it was about 15 seconds quicker.
So suggestive, it's not conclusive.
Yeah, no.
But it's interesting nonetheless. Now, you also have managed to speak to someone who is a sort of famed neurologist who has some thoughts on this particular experiment. Tell us, who was that?
Sir Roger Bannister, who is actually a lot more famous for having been the first person to run the mile in less than 4 minutes. He spent his career as a neurologist working on the autonomic nervous system. Now, the reason that's linked to this is actually these wrinkly fingers are caused by the autonomic nervous system. And this is the system, the part of the nervous system that's responsible for things we're not aware of, like heart rate and our breathing rate. So he came in because he was interested in this story, and he had some alternative ideas about why we might get these wrinkly fingers.
We know that a finger wrinkling has a neurological basis, because if the nerve to the hand is cut, the fingers don't wrinkle. The cause of the wrinkling is the reduced volume of the skin of the fingers. The cause of the reduced volume is the sympathetic autonomic fibers, which cause vasoconstriction of the arteries of the fingers. But the mystery remains of why some individuals do not have finger wrinkling.
Could you quickly explain to us a bit about what the autonomic nervous system actually is?
That part of the nervous system, someone said, Providence chose to remain out of our conscious control. So, for example, it is organs like the heart and then also the endocrine glands, and it does innervate every part of the body, every organ and every part of the skin. It is, if you like, to be separated from the somatic nervous system.
So wrinkly fingers can actually tell us something about some quite serious...
Well, you never know. Until you've followed up a piece of research, you keep on finding different surprises, and you have to follow the clues.
That was Sir Roger Bannister there, explaining why wrinkly fingers are more interesting than you think. Robin, let's move on to you. Extrasolar planets.
Yes.
There's been a lot of extrasolar planets news this week because the American Astronomical Society had its annual meeting in Long Beach, California. And so there's lots of details about potential exoplanets. There was this wonderful study that someone published looking at Kepler data that there's probably 17 billion Earth-sized planets out there, potentially... some of them is going to have life. But another theoretical paper that came out, which caught your eye, about the moons of exoplanets.
Yes.
So we've discovered loads of these things. We've 850 exoplanets, more than 2,000 candidates. Some of them are going to have moons. Tell us more about them.
Right. We've got these hundreds, thousands, potentially millions, possibly billions of planets out there going around stars throughout the rest of the galaxy. A lot of these have been found by the US Kepler satellite, which is built specifically to track
remarkable machine.
Absolutely. And it really is transforming the science of astrobiology. The only thing about the planets that are finding, the vast majority are forms of super Jupiter like planets. These are planets that are just great big gas balls. There's no solid surface, nothing on which any water can form, because they're so close to a star, in which case they burn off, or they're so far and deep and distant into space that there's no prospect of that water ever being other than solid ice. Scientists, and I've got to give the names, Rennie Hiller from Germany's Leibniz Institute of Astrophysics and Rory Barnes of the University of Washington, they suggest, well, a way around this problem may be that it's the moons that go around these planets offer us a prospect of finding life. Now, in particular, the most particularly interesting part is a moon that would go around a distant planet, one that would possibly be very, very cold and which the ice would freeze. But because the moon flies close to that planet, there's a thing called tidal heating. Basically, the planet's gravitational field distorts the shape of the moon, not very much, but enough to cause immense geological shearing of the rocks on that moon, causing them to heat up. And that moon heats up, and under its surface, under perhaps a surface of ice, you have a liquid ocean of water. And liquid oceans of water are just the thing that every scientist dreams of. That's where we believe our very best prospects of finding life are.
And this is not a ridiculous idea. Jupiter has these sorts of moons.
You've got Jupiter with possibly three. Certainly you've got Europa and Ganymede, possibly Callisto, all with watery oceans underneath it. We also have Enceladus going around Saturn, which is a small world, perhaps slightly too small, but it clearly has water because it's venting water vapour into space. So there is liquid water on that moon, despite the fact that it's in deep, deep cold space. So that the idea that exomoons have the potential, a better potential, for supporting life is borne out by studies of our own solar system. I mean, you're just a young lad, but I remember when I was, you know, first starting out in this business, people thought that the edge of the solar system, Jupiter and beyond, was cold and dead and useless, and what's the point of sending a space probe there?
They thought Jupiter was the edge of the solar system when you started.
No, I said Jupiter that, and towards the edge of the solar system. No, I'm not going back to Galileo, thank you. But they thought that these worlds out there were cold and dead, and there was no real point in looking at them. And then they find all these exomoons, which are being heated tidally, and which all sorts of strange things, and we found out that the edge of the solar system is just as interesting as the interior of it.
Well, the next set of missions from NASA and ESA hopefully will go out to those sorts of own moons in around Jupiter and Saturn, to try and sail boats in those things and work out if there's any life forms in there. But, you know, once again, science fiction's ahead of all of us.
It is indeed. Well, the most famous example is Avatar, because we have the world, the moon, Pandora in the film, and that goes around a planet that goes around Alpha Centauri, and of course it's home to an incredibly advanced life form, one that gives the Earthmen a good kicking at the end.
That's right. Well, also Return of the Jedi back in the '70s, the moons of Endor, which is where the little Ewoks lived, and you know, where the denouement of that fine, excuse me, not very fine movie happened. No, but the thing is that this is not a brand new idea, but what these guys in the paper, I suppose, have done is to quantify that to some extent and to work out from coming Kepler data, when will we get from Kepler data detections of exomoons? Because we don't have that now.
They have just started, just at the end of last year, started to look, and that it has a prospect of, they say, of finding a moon going around an exoplanet. But that moon would have to be at least the size of Mars, which is big. I don't think we're quite that size. I mean, Ganymede is the biggest moon in the solar system, and it's slightly bigger than Mercury. So it's at the edge, perhaps, of what is possible. But quite clearly, we're going to get some kind of exomoon results quite soon.
I mean, the next few decades are going to be incredibly exciting for astrobiologists, given the amount of technology we've got to actually detect moons and planets out there. We're finding them every single day. We're going to start being able to detect what's in their atmospheres using ground-based telescopes in the next couple of decades. Maria, this is a subject that, if you're a PhD student, you've got to be very excited about, because it's a whole career for some people.
Do you know, I've actually done a project on astrobiology during my master's course, and I looked at the sorts of crazy organisms that we get on Earth and where they can survive. And actually, you'd be surprised by the limits of how salty or how hot conditions can be, where kind of organisms, quite crazy organisms sometimes, but they can still survive.
And quite common. I mean, they're not sort of that rare, the organisms. I mean, there's the one that was flown up to space shuttle was from rocks from the island, the village of Beer, from the cliffs. Now, sea cliffs are quite extreme. They get bathed in radiation and things like that. But they survived a year on the outside of the space shuttle, one of these sets of organisms. So the prospects are immense. It's just getting there.
What do you reckon?
Well, you've got a choice. Are you going to find it by studying, using more and more advanced versions of Kepler to study atmospheres of other planets?
Because we're going to be able to detect oxygen or water or anything else in planets at some point soon.
Yes, and you'll be able to detect, have you got water vapor, oxygen and methane, in which case it's only going to be life if it's in some stable form. That tells you you've got a life. But to know what kind of, whether that's DNA based or whatever it is based, you're going to have to find it. So our only prospects are to go to Mars and keep drilling, or to go to Enceladus or go to Europa. And those latter two are very difficult missions to do because they have to go through powerful radiation belts of Jupiter and Saturn and immense gravities in which you've got to steer your spaceship.
Plus, you've got no idea how thick the ice actually is.
Europa. Europa is a particularly good point there.
Okay, well, we'll leave that there. Thanks to Robin McKee and to Maria Bocharova. For all those stories and more, go to guardian.co.uk/science. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. From me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.